Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zeb Larson, and I'm here today with Dr. Sarah Lorenzini to discuss her new book, Global Development, A Cold War History. Dr. Lorenzini discusses the evolution of development as an idea in light of the Cold War, which saw different factions not only using development for geostrategic objectives, but defining development in different ways according to their own interests and needs.
Dr. Lorenzini, welcome to the New Books Network. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you. My name is Sara Lorenzini and I teach international history at the University of Trento in Italy. I have studied in a lot of places, actually, but I got my PhD from the University of Florence and I studied development studies at the London School of Economics, and I've been working a lot in Germany and in German archives throughout.
So tell us a little bit about your work as a graduate student specifically.
During my PhD, I have been working on the competition between West and East Germany in Africa. And this topic actually brought me closer to development, which is my main topic and my great passion as a historian, even though it is not the only thing I have been working on. I've been working a lot on Italian foreign policy too, the history of Italy in the early Cold War. And of Italian foreign policy in the early Cold War is another of my main topics, really. But my passion lies in studying development aid and the history of development. And this is where my book, the book that we discussed today, comes from.
So this book, Global Development, tell us a little bit, I mean, just briefly, what are you arguing in this book?
So I'd single out three main lines of argument that I make in this book. And the first is that the Cold War was fundamental to construct the institutions, the concepts, and the discourse around foreign aid, the discourse that survives today. So this is probably the main point. Then another point I make, and is very important to me, is that the analysis of the history of development shows how national and international institutions promoted an idea of development as a homogeneous system that is pretty unrealistic, because I don't believe that development was and is a homogeneous system as such. And then a third point that I make in my book, and that I think is also very important when thinking about development and ideas on development and how we use development in foreign policy today, is that foreign aid was long, for all its history, actually understood as a tool to enhance the security, but it systematically failed to do so. And this is kind of one, probably the most important lesson learned from the history of development, I believe.
So let's start at the beginning, sort of chronologically, with your book. Where does this rhetoric of development come from? You even introduced the word as sort of economists became to understand it. Tell us a little bit about that.
Maybe the first thing that we have to touch upon here is the definition. What is development in this book? What kind of definition I use? Because there are in fact multiple definitions of development, as you know. And well, when I talk of development in my book, I talk of the policies that were devised to turn poor backward countries into wealthy modern ones. And well, going back to your question, where does this rhetoric of development come from? It is true. I trace back the history of the concept, not starting with the Enlightenment, but really in the 1920s, because I believe that development becomes a crucial policy and a concept to work with in the 1920s. And it is used as a tool for governing empires, as the civilizing mission of the colonial empires. And this is what development was in the beginning, a domestic policy to improve living conditions in backward areas in the empire and avoid social unrest in the empires.
So how does the United States become involved in this rhetoric of development and the idea of development?
Well, no doubt if we were to identify the turning point for the involvement of the U.S. in development and in this idea of development, the date would probably be the 20th of January 1949, when Harry Truman launched the famous Point 4, a policy of making U.S. scientific advances available to underdeveloped areas in order to fight misery, malnutrition, and illness. So this is more or less as it reads in his speech. So this is probably the first moment, but nevertheless, in my book, I also argue that it took really a while before aid became a proper tool in the toolkit of U.S. foreign policy, and with this explicit aim to fight communism that was there from the very beginning in Truman's plans and in Truman's idea. But it was only in 1956 when the Soviet Union under Khrushchev explicitly entered the competition for influence in the Third World by using foreign aid. It was only then, 1956, that aid became a weapon to fight the Cold War, really. And from then on, development, or to say it better in U.S. Foreign policy language and social scientist language, modernization became the way to engage with the global South, with the Third World, was actually the expression that was used back then.
And then, I mean, you've mentioned Khrushchev in 1956 and sort of the changing orientation of the socialist bloc, but prior to that, you charted, they have sort of an unusual history here. Where did they stand in terms of development and the global South?
Khrushchev, with his speech I have just mentioned, starts the whole, interest of the socialist bloc in development. Because earlier, the Soviet Union had not really built on the ideological advantage introduced by the revolutionary message of Lenin in his pamphlet on imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, written in 1917. Stalin wasn't interested in Third World developments. He focused on and was mainly preoccupied with defending and consolidating the Soviet Union as a state, really securing its borders. But then with decolonization and with the emergence of the Third World, the whole understanding of the potential of anti-colonialism changed, and the strategy actually shifted from indifference to attention in what has been defined, and I adopt this definition myself, as an afterthought. what Khrushchev's choice of openness toward the newly independent countries actually represents. Khrushchev is a turning point in a whole tradition of neglect, really, for quite a long time. And I don't know what you probably want to hint at the fact that I start by saying that in fact Marxism was not so much against colonialism, and that is so. I trace back the history in Marxist thought and in the debates that happened earlier on this point, where actually the international communism and international social democrats, in fact, were divided on how to deal with colonialism. Was colonialism a good thing because it helped, you know, dramatizing the class consciousness, and it helped constructing the working class, or was it bad, and was it worth thinking of straight away of revolutionary plans? So this is kind of the untold story you're hinting at. That is indeed in the chapter of my book, but nonetheless, it is really like the important turning point is indeed Khrushchev, to understand you know, this dynamic of Cold War competition for the Third World.
Now, this is a broad question. But in this period, and really running throughout, to what extent does development in the global South also serve domestic political purposes, either for the United States or potentially for the Soviet Union, or of course these European powers that are reconsidering their relationship with either colonized territories or formerly colonized territories?
Well, it's a broad question with a generic answer. Maybe then you want to go into the specifics, because development was always a way to promote national interests, so to promote economic and political strategic interests. It was and is a way to gain economic advantages, such as important contracts for raw materials, for example, or for opening up opportunities for a business, including private business abroad. And also the security rationale was indeed an important dimension of national interest. The idea that aid would avoid or contain the threat of communist insurgency at home and abroad was indeed a main pillar of the system from the very beginning, both in the colonial empires and in the United States foreign policy. Less so, obviously, in the socialist countries, who actually were very keen on revolution and on disrupting the system, obviously.
Now, there's this term that you employ, Eurafrica. You know, it's a fascinating term, and it carries all these connotations. Tell us a little bit about that and to how that's being deployed in the interest of development.
Okay, so the idea, the concept of Eurafrica, when it was devised and created, the idea of a bloc that included Europe and Africa, and that would restore Europe as a geopolitical third force between East and West. And this idea circulated widely in continental Europe in the years before decolonization, starting in the 1920s, really, but then later on too. And in the early 1950s, European leaders worked at the project of a united Europe that included the African colonies, so in the idea of Eurafrica. And this project became then, 1957, the European Economic Community, an institution that reflected at best this idea, so that in 1957, when the treaties of Rome were signed by the heads of state of the six countries building the European Economic Community, Poland, Rijksbank, the Belgian, greeted the signing of the treaties of Rome with such words: "Finally, the dream of Eurafrica comes true." So this is a story that is actually not very often told about the birth of the European Economic Community. But then you can read in my book how the European Economic Community adopted the tradition of the Union Française based on the principle of association of the colonies. So countries in Africa were associated to the community, and association was based on two major pillars: trade and aid. So development was an important dimension to the project. Trade meant preferential trade with reverse preferences in the colonial tradition, and aid was offered through the European Development Fund and financed projects of technical assistance, like in the tradition of both the Point Four and colonial aid. And then what happened is that with decolonization, this regime needed to be turned into foreign policy. In fact, it became a specific treaty, the Yaoundé Convention, which is probably the first brick of the foreign policy of the European Community. So, yeah, Eurafrica is indeed a concept that is very useful to understand at least two decades of the history of European development aid within the European Economic Community as it was devised and organized then.
Now, how did the United States work alongside Europe? Because, I mean, in many ways, United States and Western Europe are, if not strictly partners, at least allied in many ways. The United States also wants Europe to take a specific role within this. How does that play out?
Yeah, well, development was from the very beginning with Point Four devised a cooperative project of the West. So this was quite clear very early on. And this aspect became increasingly important. It became more important at the heyday of modernization in the years of the Kennedy administration. And at this point, there was another priority in U.S. foreign policy, and this priority was burden sharing. And the U.S. Administration thought it would be easier to convince European allies in NATO to contribute to sectors other than the military, other than the budget used for defense purposes. And so they thought that foreign aid could be a good terrain where the U.S. could cash some significant contribution from the partners, especially from the West Germans. And this is what several policymakers, such as Rostow, for instance, Kennedy's special advisor, thought, as you know, the future of development and cooperation between the U.S. And the allies in development. But this idea that it would be easier to involve Europeans in projects on development easier than other areas proved to be especially wrong. And this is clear, and I describe that in one chapter of my book. It is it becomes quite clear in the discussions within the DAC, the Development Assistance Committee, born in 1961 within the OECD. And, well, European partners resisted attempts to join forces in the area of development and really stick to their traditions in aid giving. And this is true both for the geographical concentration of aid and for what was a kind of a fundamental choice between program aid and project aid. So the U.S. was for program aid, that means financing complete development plans, but Europeans and especially, well, all of them, but especially the Germans were against it, and they wanted to finance specific projects only. This doesn't mean that cooperation didn't take place. It did take place, especially in consortia, where the West partnered on aid to some specific areas like Turkey, India, and Pakistan. Nevertheless, it was quite, the US had quite a hard time and didn't get what they wanted from their European allies in this respect.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, there's a global body that we haven't discussed that yet, but it's the United Nations. Where's the United Nations in this story, especially in this time period?
Well, the United Nations is very important in the history of development. Development is one of the three legs in the UN system from the very beginning, one of the fundamental goals to be achieved in the ECOSOC, the Economic and Social Council. And, well, the UN was the place where East and West met and, well, often actually also clashed on development. And my book features some of these controversies, the controversies around SUNFED, for instance, the Special UN Fund for Economic Development that was eventually dumped by the US in the early 1950s. But I think that is more important to remember and to keep in mind that the UN are especially the place where an alternative third world friendly development thinking was able to flourish in the 1950s and 1960s. And while development grows in importance within the UN setting with decolonization and the changing composition of the UN, especially the UN General Assembly, newly independent countries from Asia, Africa, and Latin America became members of the UN in the 1960s, have development as an absolute priority. So this obviously changes really the role and the, you know, the importance and the weight of the discussions about and around development, especially in the General Assembly. And within the United Nations system, the United Nations Conference for Trade and Development became the ideal place for coordinating third world political action and offered a kind of, how can we say, a neutralist alternative to the development aid and development system that was centered on the World Bank, the other big international institution dealing with development. And in my book, I deal with UNCTAD from its birth in 1964 through the momentous project of the new international economic order in the 1970s, between 1973 and 1974. And I follow actually the life of development at UNCTAD until the early 1980s and the failure of this project of the new international economic order.
Now, you've just mentioned the global south suddenly getting sort of a more of a voice in this period, especially through the UN. What are you mentioned? I mean, for development, for them, development is an absolute priority. What specifically are they? Is there a sort of coherent agenda you can assign to the global south? Is it just they wanted development, or was there a specific vision for it that at least many of these countries sought?
What actually changed the role of development within the UN system, the element I mentioned earlier in the previous answer, is are the huge changes that happened in the 1970s. So the crisis of the Bretton Woods system after 1971 helped somehow third world claims, which also enjoyed the support of the rebellious youth movements in the West starting 1968 onwards. And, you know, in this period, in the first half of the 1970s, the third world could count on the crucial strategic alliance with the oil producers, united in the OPEC, in the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, who were reclaiming sovereignty over natural resources, and they could build on the successful oil revolution, as it has been called, and the success also of the 1973 oil embargo that was a major shift for the global south, because this important backing by OPEC gave the global south really a new contractual power, putting it in an ideal position to promote its ambitious plans for economic decolonization. The economic bandung, it was called sometimes, this idea of the new international economic order that monopolized public discourse, at least in the group of the third world countries between 1973 and 1974. So this is indeed a crucial moment and turning point in this new identity of the global south around this new power given, you know, by the success of OPEC as an international organization and of its claims on sovereignty over natural resources.
Now, you spend a chapter discussing environmental consequences of these sort of visions of development. This was one of my very favorite chapters in the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So the chapter deals with the early concerns with the sustainability of growth. The Limits of Growth is the title of the most successful and controversial book discussing the predicament with growth. that is very typical for the early 1970s. And the main focus of my chapter is on the environment development nexus and how this was discussed around the UN conference on the human environment held in Stockholm in June 1972. And yeah, well, the point here was the scientific community had started complaining, in fact, that mega dams and large irrigation schemes had been evaluated according to political, economic, and also engineering parameters, but without taking into account the environmental disruption that they caused, or even the social consequences or medical consequences, ecological balance, so the idea, the fundamental idea that was discussed on the eve of the Stockholm Conference and also during the Stockholm Conference was that the environment needs to be reconsidered, to be considered as a factor, because it was crucial for the success of the real success of a development plan. There could be no effective development scheme if the environmental consequences were not considered. And this was the idea there in the background.
Now, how did individuals in the global south react to these concerns over pollution and especially overpopulation? Because this is also the period when we get Paul Ehrlich's population bomb, for example. Where are they in these discourses?
Well, developing countries were not very keen on the protection of the environment. Their priority was development. Pollution and overpopulation were problems for the rich people in the global north, and the global south needed to develop and had this as the main concern, as the only priority, really. So the developing countries tend to see environmentalism as a pretext, a mere distraction from the real problem, the problem of poverty. So this is the main point they actually make, the leaders and in developing countries, the point that they make. As for overpopulation, the question actually was pushed to the margins at the Stockholm Conference, and it was a third world that opposed any reference to population growth as a factor in maintaining ecological balance, so that the final document of the conference did not even mention it. So it was a concern, but a concern of other cultures, according to leaders from the developing countries.
And then I was just curious, where did the socialist state stand on environmental issues?
So this is a very interesting story, I believe. There were some important members in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev, like German Vishani, for instance, who thought that the environment was one of the global themes that could constitute the basis for dialogue between East and West. So this is a very interesting element, but I must say that the environment was not a major concern to the Soviet Union per se. It was maybe, kind of seen as a possibility for dialogue during the détente, but the environment was not a concern at home. It was not a priority within the Soviet Union. The socialist countries and also the communist parties in the Western world tended to classify this preoccupation for the environment as a capitalist priority and criticized this idea of the environment trumping economic growth. And so they were very much concerned with the rights of the workers, and they feared that the environment could be a pretext to cut development and would end up damaging the workers as a class. As for, the socialist bloc did not even participate in the Stockholm Conference in 1972, as you know. China did. It was the first time that the Popular Republic of China was on stage in international politics, in fact. But again, China did not represent a socialist view specifically. It represented more the point of view of the third world countries, stressing development as a priority, too. And things changed, and there is, this is again, but a totally different story of what happens later under Gorbachev, where a brand new rhetoric on the environment sets in the socialist countries with this greater consideration, greater role of disarmament as the most important measure to make sure that the environment can be preserved, because the major threat to the world and to the environment is war and nuclear war. We're in the age of the 1980s, so the second Cold War, say, the revival of the Cold War.
So how did the EEC find new ways of engaging with the Global South on development? Because that's a trend that emerges, especially in the later parts of the book, as the European economic community seems to shift.
Yeah, from this old imperial way of seeing, looking at development into something else. In the 1970s, the system experienced quite, the EEC system experienced quite a significant change that was connected with the entry of the United Kingdom in the European Economic Community. And then obviously it became self-evident that the old Euro-Africa dimension that was given disproportionate centrality to France and to the French tradition and the former French colonies could not hold much longer. So what happened is that guided by the new development commissioner, also French, they were always French development commissioners in the EEC, this guy named Claude Cheysson, who was also for a while was very crucial personality in European and French foreign policy throughout the second half of the 1970s till the late 1980s. Under the guide of Cheysson, the European Economic Community worked for a new agreement to replace Yaoundé, including the former British colonies in Africa. And this new agreement was the Lomé Convention that was signed in February 1975. Lomé essentially meant to extend association with the EEC to these other colonies. So in the end, it was former colonies. Sorry, in the end, it was 46 countries were the participant in this new agreement. And the main novelty of the agreement was in the trade regime with on the one hand, the abolition of reverse preferences, so the old imperial rules, and on the other hand, the introduction of STABEX, a mechanism for price stabilization of raw materials that was meant to protect third world countries against price volatility of their primary commodities, their exports. And both of these requests reflected the desires of the third world countries. So the requests that were expressed in UNCTAD by the countries of the Global South, the requests that were at the center of the debate on the new international economic order that takes place exactly in those years, right? And And then, you know, Shi Sun was also a very clever guy, politically very clever, because he fashioned European policies as an answer to the demands of the new international economic order and presented the European strategy as an ideal complement with non-alignment. Tomorrow's Europe, he said, has its extension in the third world. So this idea of this unity, this special relationship of the European Economic Community and the third world is the big novelty that comes as also as a new identity of Europe in the 1970s, and that is played by European leaders starting from the mid-1970s onwards constantly as, you know, a kind of idea for a strategic orientation of Europe.
Now, in one of your later chapters, you discuss attempts to try to reform the system via an organization, the NIEO. That ultimately fails. Why does it fail, and what was the reform? The sort of trying to be pushed through to this system.
The new international economic order was this radical project of reforming of the international economic system. And actually, no actor, with the exception of the European Economic Community that supported that, well, partially only, because in the end, not so much, because the money, for example, that was invested in STABEX, in this stabilization of prices of raw material, was really limited. So actually, there was not such a huge concrete support. But, in general, in the global north, there was no important actor supporting the new international economic order, no national government. With the exception of the European Economic Community, there was really no one taking sides with this project. And, well, actually what happened is that the rich countries in the West found actually a new unity in the G7 in their opposition to this third world radicalism, to this idea of revolutionizing the international economic system. The third world did not have the support of the socialist bloc either, because for the Soviet Union and the allies of the Soviet Union, the new international economic order was all in all capitalist plan, and the real alternative for the poor countries was socialism, was joining the Comecon, was joining the socialist bloc in its economic organization, the Council of Mutual Economic Assistance. And then on top of that, we have to add that the rich countries in the West were especially successful in breaking third world unity. They were very explicit on this point, this idea of dividing the rich oil countries and the least developed non-oil countries that were hit by the oil crisis. So the third world ceased to be a cohesive and organized force. And actually, there were these two groups, the moderates with India, Egypt, and Indonesia, and the radicals, Iraq, Libya, Vietnam, with Cuba, that were facing each other within the non-aligned movement. So a huge split in the third world that was one of the main factors why, together with the worsening financial condition of third world countries in the 1980s, the debt crisis, well, this all brought to, eliminating the new international economic order from the agenda.
So briefly for our listeners, just contextualize what that debt crisis was and what it meant, and then how does that shape discourses around development?
So the debt crisis is this huge skyrocketing of debts that were typical for third world country economies starting in the 1960s, and in the 1980s the amount of these debts became especially heavy and tragic and caused specific shocks, especially in Latin America. The 1980s are generally considered the last decade for development. For many reasons, criticism on aid as a corrupt and ineffective system came from all sides, with also explicit criticism on the morality of aid. But on top of that, in the 1980s, and as a consequence of these problems with financing development and refinancing debt, the International Economic Institution introduced structural adjustment programs. And also the neoliberal doctrines tended to link growth to cutting expenditures and promoting openness. Not anymore, growth was not anymore linked to development planning or industrialization as it was earlier. And so this actually pictured and composed a very oblique picture for aid that only partially recovered at the end of the Cold War, because the neoliberal era was there to stay for quite a long time and still with us. Yeah.
So I always like to seek applications. Present, are there any lessons we can take away from this history for the 21st century?
I must say that aid was one, or has been described very often as one of the greatest disappointments of the 20th century, because it could never accomplish all the many diverse goals that all different actors hoped for, because it was not effective or not effective enough in securing alliances. It could not grant security or create political stability in the way the donors or the recipients hoped for. It could not erase poverty and inequality, not among individuals, not among countries. This all, disappointment with the partial results of aid and constant analysis that took place starting from the 1980s, but also earlier. I bet the first analysis of this kind take place in 1968 on the effectiveness of the aid system. So all these considerations about does aid work are answered, most of the times in the negative. However, we cannot forget really that there were, and if we look at the World Bank statistics today, we see that in terms of poverty alleviation, we have indeed achieved important results at the global level, at least. So I don't feel that we should be so negative in the whole about the whole history of development. But one thing that I want to focus on, and I think, and for which I think that it is useful to read and tell the history of development, is that it is important, and we see that in the specific case studies, to avoid the general recipes, so this one-size-fits-all approach that indeed was something that was not good for achieving good results in the long history of development aid throughout the Cold War and even after.
Quick question, and I know this can sometimes be sensitive because you've just finished a book, but what are you thinking of working on next?
Oh, okay, next projects. Well, right now, and you may have noticed from the details I gave on the, on that specific point, I am writing on European exceptionalism and the origins of the foreign policy of the European Union. So this is these are the things that I'm working on now. But my next big projects will probably be on dams in Africa, and especially the ones built by Impregilo, now Salini, this big Italian, well, dam builder, with a focus on the security implications of dam constructions and the environmental consequences too. So this is what is coming up next, but it will take some time before it's done.
Such as academic publishing. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thanks to you very much for the interview. It was lovely to talk to you.